If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Friday, May the 25th and beginning of Memorial Day weekend, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow. Joining me today in studio here on the campus of Stanford University, Douglas Rivers. He's a senior fellow here at the Hoover Institution and a professor of political science at Stanford. He's also the chief scientist at YouGov PLC, a global polling firm. And his Twitter description, quote, absent-minded professor, sometime entrepreneur, pollster, and econometrician. We always jump right into numbers when we do these podcasts, Doug. Let's back
that's
up a second.
That's what I do, Bill.
Yes, that's what you do. Let's back up a second, though. Let's talk about polling itself. What drew you into the business of polling? What attracted you at the numbers and the sort of dark arts of trying to figure out who's popular and who's not?
Well, I think if you ask a lot of pollsters their childhood interests, it's usually baseball statistics. In my case, it was more basketball and math. Collecting data in mm-hmm. politics, and particularly survey data, is a thing that attracts people with a certain level of interest in math and lack of other normal human pursuits.
Interesting. So you're sort of a growing up a sabermetrician, a Bill James kind of person, right?
Yes.
Very much.
We try to turn everything into numbers, which drives my wife in particular to distraction.
Right. And you do polling with YouGov, which is internet-based polling. I'm old enough to remember, Doug, when the internet came of age in politics in the 2000 election cycle, and candidates started talking boldly about raising money on the internet, and there was this enormous pushback. I'm not going to put my credit card on the internet and give candidates money that way. You fast forward to 2016, I think Bernie Sanders raised something like $6 or $8 million in the 24 hours after the New Hampshire primary, just based on people going online and giving money to his website. What about internet polling, though? When did internet polling really start to come of age?
Yeah, so internet polling started actually very soon after the birth of the internet. Mm-hmm. So in 1996, Harris Interactive and some people, other companies were doing mostly market research. And it took off very quickly in the market research realm. So essentially, no market research, consumer market research, is done on the phone or in person or by mail any longer. It moved to the internet really by 2000. I started two companies to do online polling, one called Knowledge Networks in 1998, which took a very expensive approach because we were worried there were only a quarter of the people were on the internet, so we gave them hardware. We gave them little set-top boxes that sat on top of their TV, and they could answer the polls on their TV.
Right.
That was too expensive a model in general for political polling. So in 2004, I started Polymetrics, which was an attempt to use some of the methodologies that have been used in market research, which are very large opt-in panels. You try to recruit 1 million people, and then you assemble a sample, not by random selection, but by systematically picking out people to be representative. Mm-hmm. That had enormous resistance in the polling community that was using random digit dialing, randomly picking out phone numbers. Over time, that just subsided, so that I would say 2016 was certainly the year it took over, that all the campaigns did large amounts of online polling. CBS, NBC, everyone other than ABC,
right,
did a certain amount of online polling, typically using opt-in samples of one type or another. So we're over the point where it's really controversial.
Right. And to clarify, there are two kinds of internet polling. There is serious academic internet polling, which you do. Then there is the snapshot polling, which is who won the debate. What do you think about Korea? The overnight instant analyses that people tend to flood, people tend to spam.
Yeah, we carefully avoid confusion with the 1-900 dial-in poll from the early days.
Or the Drudge Who Do You Think Won the Debate poll, things like that.
We do instant polling, but it's done off a pre-recruited panel as opposed to people, you know, coming in right at the moment, which you can get really skewed samples. There's a debate in the academic world between the ones that use my, what I would call version 1.0, where you actually recruit people by conventional means, mail or phone, and then recruit them to an internet panel. There are a small set of sort of academic surveys that run that way, and it costs, you know, 5x as much. Versus the large opt-in panel, which has really sort of carried the day.
So tell me what you were polling in the midterm election. So YouGov has a partnership with The Economist. So you're doing a weekly tracking poll with them, right?
We do a weekly tracker with The Economist. We're also the main pollster for CBS News. And we will be coming out with a survey in about 10 days on the competitive congressional districts with them. Which I can't tell you the results on because I don't know what they are. It's in the field now.
Okay, let's get to the national in a minute, but let's focus, since we're sitting here in California, let's talk a bit about what's going on in California, since there is a primary coming up in about a week and a half. And I look at, first of all, there are a lot of polls floating around out there, Doug, and they vary wildly. You find some polls where Gavin Newsom has a formidable lead. He's lieutenant governor, Democrat. He's up to 30% in some polls. In some polls, he has a 2-1, 3-1 lead over the next closest candidate. In some polls, Doug, there's a Republican named John Cox, who actually runs strongly in second place. Other polls have Antonio Villaraigosa, the former Democratic mayor of Los Angeles, close to second place. Some polls have him missing in action in polls altogether. Some polls, Doug, show 30 to 40% of the electorate undecided or just not paying attention. So you, as a professional pollster, a connoisseur of polls, how do you make sense of all this information flying around here?
All right. So the first thing is you are seeing some phone polls being reported. As well as some internet polls. So the recent poll that came out of the Institute for Governmental Studies at Berkeley.
That's the former field poll, right?
It's now run by Mark DiCamillo, who ran the field poll for years, took over after Murph Field died. Very good pollster. They're running, I don't know exactly how they do it, but it is an online poll. I've read the methodology and seems reasonable, but it's not exactly clear to me what they're doing. But the reason I mention that is that, and we've run a poll, which presumably we'll talk about in a few minutes. At Stanford, a joint project between Hoover and the Lane Center. But online versus telephone makes a big difference here. Because we have a lot of candidates running for the statewide races. And in a phone survey, you have to read people the list of candidates. And if the candidate list is really long, they will have forgotten half the names by the time you get to the end or gotten impatient.
Right. So let's talk about that, Doug. So California operates under a top two primary system, or open primary, jungle primary, whatever prefix you want to use. But the way it works is everybody goes on the same ballot. The top two vote getters advance to November, regardless of party affiliation. And for a voter, this is a challenge because on the gubernatorial side, there are 27 names put before you. On the senatorial side, I think there are 32 names. And you've noticed that there's a difference when you throw all the names at people versus a select number of names.
Right. So if you're running an online poll, you can show someone the entire list. That would seem to be a good idea as compared to picking a small set because it more mimics the actual situation in the voting booth or the vote by mail, which of course is going to be over half the vote this time. It would seem to be, it's not obvious that's an advantage. So we did it two different ways. So we did a short list, and then we came back a week later and actually gave the full list so we could see how the candidates would split. And the results, I think, are fascinating, that you get quite different results when you pare the candidates down for the voters versus giving them the full list. I'm not completely sure which one to trust, because as you mentioned, the real problem here is a lot of voters really aren't paying attention.
Right.
That we know pretty much who's going to be the leading candidate in both these races, so it's really a race for who the other candidate is. That's big stakes for us political junkies. Mm-hmm. For the average person, it's like the consolation game in the NCAA tournament. I think they got rid of it eventually.
They did.
In the gubernatorial primary, we did a list that included Cox as the only Republican candidate,
right, John Cox,
who's been endorsed by Trump, and mm-hmm. And then we had Gavin Newsom, who's assumed to be a shoo-in. We had Villaraigosa, and then we had three other candidates. I guess actually we did have Allen, another Republican, on that.
Right.
And so it came out with Newsom at 30% mm-hmm. In the lead, but something less than a majority support.
Right.
We had Cox next at 14%. Mm-hmm. We had Allen at 12% and Villaraigosa at only 8%.
Right.
And I think there have been quite a few polls showing Villaraigosa performing poorly.
Yes.
The way this race is supposed to work with a jungle primary is the candidates are supposed to appeal to the middle of the electorate.
Right.
Pull Newsom into the center, even though he's been running fairly left, which is... and then you've got two Republicans here basically splitting the Republican vote.
Right.
When you ask, do the complete list, let me give you what the numbers are there. We now have Newsom actually goes up to 33% because I think there's an effect of people recognize the name and
right.
Pick it out. Villaraigosa is still at about 9%. Let's give you the other ones. Let's see order in which they've been put here. Cox is now at 17% and Allen is at 10%. The ordering there is still pretty much the same.
Be Newsom then Cox.
Yeah. So it looks like we'd end up with a Democrat and a Republican in a race. And the reason that's important is that it's likely the Republicans are going to be shut out in the Senate side.
Right.
If there's no Republican at the top of the ballot, it means that both top of the ballot races would generate only Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And the top of the ballot races are the ones that seem to drive turnout. Right. Rather than congressional elections, which for most people are much lower stakes.
Right. There's an interesting clash going on inside Democratic circles. Newsom has spent money attacking Cox, not because he fears Cox, but because Jesse opposite, he wants Cox as an opponent.
Right.
So the thinking is, Gavin Newsom, as somebody who Republicans really don't like, am going to spend money beating up John Cox to therefore make John Cox look sympathetic and thus draw support to Cox so I can get him in November.
Right.
So Newsom wants to run against Republican Doug because why? Democrats have a 19-point advantage in voter registration in California.
Right.
You do math for a living, the math suggests he has a pretty good chance of getting elected if he gets that matchup. Somebody who this does not please, though, is Nancy Pelosi. And why? Because Nancy Pelosi is in the business of trying to flip seats in California, House districts. Districts occupied by Republicans either running for re-election or retiring, and she would love nothing more than to have Republicans vacant at the top of the ticket. So here are the short-term needs of Gavin Newsom clash with the short-term needs of Nancy Pelosi.
Absolutely. And Yeah, so the situation, and first it's ironic that running negative ads would actually mobilize the voters of the other side.
Right.
But I think that's the case. We have some data on that. There are a lot of marginal Republican congressional seats in the states.
Right.
Trump, if he's done nothing else, has energized the Democratic base nationally.
Yes.
And even in California, which is uncompetitive, California Democrats want a way to go out and vote against Donald Trump. The Democrats are expecting good turnout of their base this year, regardless of the lack of interesting elections. The Republican base in California is just small statewide. And the question is, will this depress Republican turnout in places where they actually are the majority, which they are in a bunch of CDs?
Right. So part of what we're going to have to find out, Doug, is how popular Donald Trump is in these various Republican House districts. And there are 53 House districts in California, 14 currently occupied by Republicans. 10 are considered competitive in this cycle, and the Democrats right. have their eye on 7. In particular. But if you look at the numbers inside some of these districts, you see Donald Trump bouncing back. He's sort of bubbling back up. And this would match a national trend I want you to address, Doug, which is where Donald Trump is right now, popularity-wise. I think RCP, the Real Clear Politics average, has something like 43%, maybe a couple of decimals on that, which is about where he was before he fired James Comey.
Yeah, so 43 is not a great number, but for Trump, if we're grading on a curve, it's a pretty good number.
It's about where he was when he walked in the door, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, most presidents start at 90% approval and then inevitably go down as they lose the opposition party identifiers.
Yes.
And Trump chucked them out in his inaugural address. There was no attempt to head to the center. It was a base strategy from the beginning,
right.
driven by Steve Bannon. But the interesting thing is, I would have guessed, if you asked me the sequence of events between inauguration and now, except for the economy, I would have said, wow, those are going to put a president in the low 30s, and right. he is definitely not there. So is that due to the economy? Is it due to an effective base mobilization strategy? Mm-hmm. Really hard to say.
Right.
The economy is good. He's fairly effective at taking credit for it. But the tax bill has not turned around economic numbers for independents or Democrats. Mm-hmm. So my gut, and this is more gut than data, is saying what Trump has managed to do is an effective base mobilization strategy, that he is running at approval numbers among Republicans that look like any other Republican president. Mm-hmm. And that'll get you to around, a number in the 40s. I don't think he's, converting, working class Democrats or, people who voted against him.
Right. That was my next question. If Trump is back to where he was when all this began, has he really moved any numbers at all, you think, within the coalition, Doug, or is it just as simple as the people who don't like Donald Trump then still don't like him now, and the people who liked him then are back to liking him now?
So among Democrats, they never liked Trump.
Right.
They still don't like Trump. Mm-hmm. There's no movement on that.
But you're also suggesting he's not going out of his way to attract them.
That's right.
Right.
But what he has done, and whether it's he's done it or the base has come home, mm-hmm. he has managed to take the Republicans that were iffy about him, not the never Trumpers, which are a very small number of,
right.
but the maybe, I'll be with Trump as long as I agree with him. I will not support him when he embarrasses me. And that group is basically supporting Trump and has actually come to the point where they defend him. Mm-hmm. So they've become anti-FBI, which is a remarkable turn of events. The Republicans, the Law and Order Party, have negative views of the FBI and the intelligence establishment, and you name it.
Yeah, you and I.
Who would have thought?
You and I are of a generation growing up seeing Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. walking around with an FBI badge on TV. So that is a change. This does create a question, Doug, of Democratic messaging. If Trump is back into the 40s, if his numbers are now what they were then, if he is bubbling back up in Republican districts, what exactly do you do to run against him in November? The Democrats have had a plan in effect for a while now, which they called the Better Deal. And the Better Deal, Fair Deal, New Deal, Democrats love deals, was based a lot on economics, on jobs, on good wages. And that seems to be overshadowed by relatively good economic news. So earlier this week, Doug, the Democrats shifted strategy in effect, and they put out a memo. And here's what the memo read in part. I'll read this to you now, Doug. Quote, the American people are sick of getting a raw deal. So Better Deal is now a raw deal. The American people are sick of getting a raw deal from Washington, and they're tired of broken promises to, quote, drain the swamp. It's an endless cycle taken to a completely unprecedented level under President Trump, demonstrating a blatant disregard for the laws and norms in place to prevent public corruption. So here's the question, Doug. If drain the swamp worked for Donald Trump in 2016, can it work for Democrats in 2018?
Yeah. So Trump in 2016 certainly took advantage of widespread distrust of government in general, which exists on the left and the right. There's a debate among academic political scientists of whether it was an economic distress message or a cultural message. And most people are coming down on the side of it being a cultural message. And I think there's a lot of evidence in favor of that. And let me step back from sort of longer term view. Mm-hmm. The Republicans' big problem of winning national majorities is they're perceived as the party of the rich.
Right.
And what's the corresponding problem for the Democrats? It's that they're perceived as being the party of minorities.
Right.
Republicans are not going to walk away from their belief in free markets, which get widely perceived as being parties of the rich, and Democrats certainly are not going to walk away from being the party of equality. But the question is, what happens to white working class voters in there who view the Democrats' support for equal rights, affirmative action, immigration, as being not caring about them? And for the Democrats to thread the needle, they need a message that says we're not only for our base of minorities, we're going to do things for working class Americans who are not minority members. And so far, that message really doesn't stick. The single best issue for Democrats on that is the minimum wage. That is, there's very widespread support for minimum wage increases, and it goes against the Republican basic value and belief in free markets. So Democrats always bring it up.
Right.
It doesn't seem to be working much this cycle. The Democratic base is in favor of it. Republican base is generally skeptical or opposed, but it doesn't seem to be moving any voters.
Right. But, Doug, when you shift from better deal to raw deal, you're now running on a message of throw out the bums, anti-institutional hostility. Is any of your polling data suggests that there's this kind of pent-up frustration, this vehemence against Congress, specifically a Republican-led Congress?
Yeah, so there's negative views on Congress across the board.
Institution, of course, yeah. Right.
Yeah, so it's neither Democrats nor Republicans like Congress. The drain the swamp thing is a Trump line, and the Democrats run against Trump.
Right.
The problem is, as Republicans have embraced Trump, that doesn't get you marginal Republican voters. Maybe it does okay among independents.
Right.
The anti-Washington view, what Democrats need is essentially to wrap Trump up with Republicans in Congress and corruption.
Right.
And that becomes a complete anti-Trump message, which so far hasn't really worked. Mm-hmm. I would have thought it would have been effective given the events of the last year, but it hasn't taken off.
Right. So two other factors to kick in here, Doug. One is Nancy Pelosi. If you are going to turn, if you're going to flip the House and give the House back to the Democrats, you're talking about a message of change. She does not necessarily embody change.
So Nancy Pelosi is less popular than Donald Trump.
No kidding.
though so is Mitch McConnell,
yeah.
who's even less popular.
Actually, let's talk about that for a second. Why would especially Mitch McConnell be less popular, since Mitch McConnell is not on TV every day like Donald Trump is? Mitch McConnell is not dominating just conversations. I don't know, when you walk around outside, Doug, and just go by a Starbucks or someplace like that, I'm shocked how many times I hear Donald Trump's name mentioned out loud, usually by some profanities with it. He's in people's heads, but Mitch McConnell?
Yeah, well... first, Trump sucks the oxygen out of the room here. So no one is talking about much of anyone other than Donald Trump and who his foil is
this,
that week.
By the way, might be one of the factors, Doug, when we look at the California electorate and see a big, large, sleepy chunk of it. It just might be because Donald Trump is so much in the damn news every day that maybe it's hard to focus on other things going on.
You know, no one else has any visibility.
Right.
You can see McConnell's numbers went down when Trump attacked them. And they've yet to recover, even though McConnell and Trump are now BFFs.
Yes.
The Pelosi thing is, when I see Republicans running against Pelosi, she's unpopular. She polls badly. She certainly doesn't pull Democrats up. But it's really an act of desperation on the Republican side, because Pelosi is actually not, you know, relatively low profile in comparison.
Right.
As someone said, I don't hear anything about Nancy Pelosi paying off Playboy models or porn stars.
Right. Obviously, Pelosi is going to generate an enormous partisan split in polling, Doug. What about a gender split with her on polling? Do women rally to her?
Not really.
No.
I mean, there's a huge gender split on Trump that's bigger than normal. So we're looking at, you know, 14, 15 point gender gaps.
Right.
Which is, you know, the normal is typically in the range of half that.
Right.
The thing that determines how you feel about Pelosi is whether you're a partisan Democrat or not.
Okay.
So Democrats think she's okay and Republicans hate her.
Interesting. One other topic, Doug, is impeachment. If you go back to 2006, in the middle of May of 2006, the Democrats the House Democrats had a caucus meeting. And at the caucus meeting, they started talking about impeachment. Word of this got out. It got run in a couple of newspapers. And Nancy Pelosi went on TV as fast as she could and said that impeachment is not happening. She took it off the table. She's been doing interviews this week, and she is trying to sort of have it both ways, where she is kind of suggesting, well, maybe not, but that she's not ruling it out either. So it's kind of a delicate balancing act she's doing. Now, if you look at the poll, which we have coming out from the Lane Center in Hoover, impeachment's a popular notion with California, especially among California Democrats. But your sense nationally as to how it plays, Doug?
So impeachment is a base issue. The Democratic base would like nothing more than to impeach Donald Trump. And the small matter of that's going to have absolutely no effect. And you're repeating the playbook of the Republicans in 1998.
Right.
So Pelosi is a complete Washington insider, and she understands that this is a losing proposition for them.
Right.
And so in reality, everyone knows that she would like to keep this, the Democrats, from walking the plank and voting for impeachment, which would be popular in Democratic districts, unpopular in Republican districts, and unpopular among swing voters, independents.
Right. But let's say in a swing district where you have, Doug, a very competitive Republican-Democratic race, and Tom Steyer, your friend up in San Francisco, who runs the Need to Impeach website, which has about 5.4 million signatures on it.
And more dollars.
Tom Steyer has money to hand out. Yeah. I think we kick ourselves wondering how we didn't get on that gravy train. But Tom Steyer could easily run ads in every district in America if he wanted to, calling for impeachment and making impeachment a litmus test.
And this is, Republicans think this is good for them.
Right.
What people want, who are swing voters, moderates, and independents, and not a member of the base of either party, is some return to normalcy. Mm-hmm. And impeachment is abnormal. It's a constitutional crisis. And what would happen if you had a Democratic majority in the House? You certainly could get a majority or close to it. Well, first, if they believed they could get rid of Trump, they would do it in a second. There are probably some Republicans that would also go for that if
right.
they could get Mike Pence instead. But the fact is that anything the House does is going to result in nothing other than a long-term distraction in the Senate at the moment. There just isn't anything close to widespread public right. support to do right. this. And, you know, Republicans look on this as if the Democrats want to sign up for this, they are essentially telling moderate voters that they will not be moderate. You know, what those voters want is people to get along, to compromise, to have less noise.
Right.
And, you know, that's a recipe for disaster.
It's interesting if you go back and you look at the 98 impeachment votes, Doug, mm-hmm. where the Republicans vote on four articles of impeachment. It's not like every Republican voted for impeachment. I think on the two items they passed forward to the Senate, I think about a dozen or so Republicans defected right. each time. So the Democrats, first of all, Doug, have to take back the House and probably have to get somewhere in the neighborhood of 235 or so seats just so they could afford to let 12 people right. walk. So that's issue number one. But then you're right, you go to the Senate where you need 67 votes to impeach. We haven't talked about Senate races, but you give me a scenario in which either A, there are 67 Democratic senators next year,
or I think that one's impossible.
Or more to the point, let's say 51. In the wildest Democratic dreams, Doug, how many seats would they get next year? This is they're holding every seat, and then they'd have to pick up the likes of
the inside straight. Has the Democrats pick up Nevada, Arizona,
Tennessee, Mississippi, right?
Well, Mississippi's not going to happen.
Okay, so at least three.
You know, Texas. You know, the Democrats have a pretty good candidate running against
right, yeah,
Ted
Beto.
Cruz, but
right.
that's a big uphill. You know, so there are three or four that they could pick up.
Okay, so you're getting
and then
them,
they would have
right.
to hold
all the ten Trump states that have Democratic incumbents.
Right, right. And they're you know, West Virginia, Indiana, Missouri,
North Dakota, Montana.
Right. Those are all tough races for yes. Democrats. Right. They got pretty good candidates in all those,
right.
but, you know, it's
right.
But unlikely they could hold all
any
of
Democratic
those.
Dream scenario, Doug, where just the world crashes on Republicans, they get everything and more they want in November.
So that'd be 53.
52, 53 seats in the Senate. They've got to go find 14 more Republicans to convict Donald Trump.
Right.
And here now you get into the math of the country where you're going to have a very dug-in minority of Republicans for some very seriously red states.
Yeah. So the only scenario where that occurs is that evidence comes out that is a
right.
smoking gun.
Yeah, this is Barry Goldwater going to the White House and saying the jig is up.
So, right. But with what we have at the moment and what I'm aware of, that just isn't in the cards. So it's a suicide mission. And I think most, you know, national Democrats will tell you privately that what Tom Steyer is doing is counterproductive.
Yeah.
That, you know, the Democrats, you know, Trump has been quite effective at appointing Republican judges. Mm-hmm. That's been managed effectively by McConnell.
Right.
The only way to stop that is to get a couple more Democratic votes in the Senate. And that's not going to happen if you run a base campaign on impeachment.
Precisely. House Republicans found some joyous news this week, Doug, and that was the generic poll. They found one generic poll in particular. There are a lot of generic polls floating around out there. Surprise, surprise. What they latched onto was one by Reuters, Doug, which showed Republicans at 38, Democrats at 37, 16% undecided, 7 in favor of a third-party candidate. Why did Republicans latch onto that? Because in April, that poll had the Democrats ahead in it. Now they show the Democrats trailing by one. Feel free to sermonize now on generic polls.
Well, first I'll sermonize on single polls.
Single polls, but let's talk about what your generic ballot shows right now.
Yeah, so we show Democrats up 4.8% on the generic ballot. I'll come back to what that means or doesn't mean.
Right.
But that's a weekly poll that we run of, you know, I think that's 1,500 people each week. Mm-hmm. Typical polls are 1,000, maybe 2,000. So they're going to bounce around by 3 or 4 points week right. to week. So one poll having the Republicans ahead doesn't do much for me. Now, overall, it's clear that the Democratic advantage in the generic ballot, which was averaging, you know, 6-7 points mm-hmm. 6 months ago, and now is averaging, you know, on the order of 3 or 4, is tighter than it was.
Right.
Okay. Now, next thing is, so the generic ballot, to be clear, what it is, you know, there are 435 congressional elections. They all have different candidates in it. If you're running a national poll of 1,000 or so, you're getting an average of 2 people per congressional district. So instead of asking about the specific candidates, we say, do you favor the Democrats or Republicans in that?
Right.
That gives you a sort of overall national picture of what it is. Mm-hmm. But we have to remember that Hillary Clinton defeated Donald Trump by over 2 points nationwide, and she lost the election. And we're in a situation where the way the seats are laid out, apportioned, there's clearly a Republican advantage. Mm-hmm. That is, if the Republicans were to win the national vote by 1%, they would retain their majority in the House with near certainty. Mm-hmm. There's a debate on how big a majority the Democrats need in the generic ballot or the national vote to win. I do not agree with people who say it needs to be 6 or 7 points or even 5 points. But it could be as much as 3, mm-hmm. That the Democrats could win the national vote by 3 points and still lose control of the House. We're at a point where the generic ballot predicts about an even outcome, certainly not a supermajority wave election.
You're suggesting that the overall does not matter because it's real estate, it's location, location, location. So
right.
Democrats could do well nationally, but if you go into specific districts, Republicans could pick off the districts they need to hold on.
Yeah, so for all except 100 races,
right.
We can tell you which party is going to win. Except unless there's a bizarre scandal in a race.
Right.
You know, so most of your polling power, that is 3/4 of your interviews, are in places where I don't need the poll to tell me who's going to win,
right.
Which is why we are doing competitive seat polling for CBS. Mm-hmm. Right now, we don't know who all the candidates are, and we don't know which ones exactly will be competitive. That's going to right. largely be sorted out in the next few weeks, mm-hmm. though there are some seats where the candidates aren't selected till September.
Right, and this is worth noting in California, going back to the primary system here, where in some of these House districts you have half a dozen Democrats running against half a dozen Republicans, and it's sort of like the card game. It's like playing 52-card pickup.
Right.
You're not sure what 2 cards you're going to pick up at the end of the day. I could build you a case in the district of Dana Rohrabacher.
Yes.
Where Democrats are pouring in money right now trying to beef up their candidates because they fear 2 Republicans making the runoff.
Yeah.
Conversely, I could point you to a seat. Ed Royce's, the 39th Congressional District, probably the most competitive seat in California. There's a shot 2 Republicans could get it, but I could also build you a scenario, Doug, where 2 Democrats walk away because you have a dozen candidates all diluting from the same pool.
Yeah, it's remarkable that these are seats, you know, the Rohrabacher seat is a seat the Democrats could win.
Yes.
But there's a fair, you know, if you look at the polls at the moment, there's no Democrat in the top 2.
Right.
I think the Democrats feel if they could get a candidate on the fall ballot with enough money, that's a seat they could win. And similarly, the Royce seat is very hard to predict what's going on. And the polling, there's a lot less polling in congressional races,
right.
and it typically is of lower quality. And the reasons for that is that within a congressional district, there's much less sort of data on the geography of those seats. So you're making a stat, more of a stab at what the electorate looks like, mm-hmm. Than you are in a statewide or a national race.
Right. So getting back to your love of basketball, Doug, there is an old joke about the National Basketball Association that you don't turn on an NBA game until the fourth quarter because that's really when the game begins.
Yeah.
Are we heading into the fourth quarter now of this midterm election?
No.
No. When does the fourth quarter begin?
The fourth quarter will begin after Labor Day.
After Labor Day. So the fourth quarter. So if you're talking about a two-year election cycle, in effect what we're saying is the fourth quarter is really a sprint of a couple of months.
Yeah. For people like us, you know, we want to play year-round basketball.
Yes.
I guess in honor of the NBA, the season doesn't end until June.
The NBA actually has been, not to get too far off topic, the NBA has very brilliantly over the past few years, Doug, found a way to stretch its season beyond the playoffs, which end in June, but now free agency talk. So you're going to get a couple months of what's LeBron James going to do.
Yes.
And then before you know it, it'll be training camp and then the season will be underway. So they're almost like the NFL, almost a year-round sport in terms of national attention.
And Trump has made politics a year-round sport too.
Almost too much so. So if this is not the third quarter, this is the third quarter then.
Yes. This is determining whether we are going to have a close game or a blowout.
So that's the question. What does an enlightened voter, an enlightened citizen do in the third quarter? Does he or she stay the heck away from politics and have a life? Do they start paying attention to polls? What really should their involvement be at this point?
Yeah, so from the professional standpoint, the idea is to figure out where you can run a competitive race.
Right. And the idea is obviously to religiously read Doug Rivers' polls each week as well.
Yes.
But
but we're struggling to poll congressional races at this point. A lot of the results look a little screwy, and it's clear that congressional elections are going to have turnout that's under 50%, well under 50%. Mm-hmm. And congressional primaries typically are in the order of you getting a quarter of the electorate participating.
Right.
The big challenge for us is to figure out who is paying attention at this point and who.
Right.
And so when we ask people how they're going to vote, lots of people tell us they're going to vote.
Right.
But I don't think they really are. And these big undecided numbers, like some of the ones we're seeing in California, north of 30% undecided, are telling you there's a big chunk of the electorate that really hasn't focused at all on this.
But in terms of doing a poll, Doug, is this like 2016 where you're trying to figure out the Trump discombobulation factor, if you will?
Yeah, so 2016 was unusual because turnout made a difference. It typically sort of, in the end, sort of balances out in a presidential election. And we had low Democratic turnout and high Republican turnout and in exactly the right places. That's a 100-year flood. Midterm elections are the opposite. They always have a turnout effect. And some of it is uncontrollable things like where you have statewide races. So in one-third of the states, there is no Senate election. There's no governor's election, so there's no statewide that is easy for people to understand. Mm-hmm. So congressional elections always have a big turnout impact of can you get voters out where there isn't a big national thing attracting people. The waves that we see in congressional elections typically come from national discontent, where the local candidates and so forth are less consequential than the national level of, approval or discontent.
Okay, final question, Doug. It's a little offbeat, but I want you to take a stab at it anyway. It's not just Trump who is in the news. It's just sort of cause celebs each week as well, just things which just get the public divided and all in a stir. Mm. This week, for example, we have Harvey Weinstein getting arrested in New York. We have the NFL coming out with just a kind of impossibly complicated policy on players kneeling or not. You do polling on the parties, but you also add questions in your polls about different topics going on. What has surprised you in the way of sort of, side issues, if you will, like the NFL, like Harvey Weinstein? What, if anything, is permeating out there that maybe people should be thinking about?
Yeah, so let's start with the Democratic issues. Mm-hmm. So Me Too, which is Harvey Weinstein, started it.
But yeah, actually, let's back up a second. When we talk about Democratic issues, you were saying before we came on the air that Democrats are motivated in this election by
two issues.
Yes.
Women's issues, Me Too, mm-hmm. and gun control.
And gun control, okay. And what motivates Republicans?
Immigration, And interestingly enough, abortion and cultural issues.
Okay.
Which I take the NFL as to be a cultural issue.
Right. So in all these other random side things that you're throwing into your tracking polls, what has surprised you out there, Doug? What has legs that maybe we don't realize?
Well, we're waiting to see whether gun control, which typically works out to be a great issue for Republicans, it mobilizes their base and it doesn't mobilize the Democratic base.
It does not.
Yeah, so Democrats, they're very pro-gun control, they care about it,
right.
But it's in the end, it doesn't bring out voters the
way. So as we're doing this podcast, there's actually the news today is that there has been another shooting at a middle school in Indiana. So you're saying that when an event like that happens, that that actually bounces the Republican base more than the Democratic base?
Yeah, because the thing that explains these working class whites and rural and suburban traditionally Democratic areas is guns and religion.
Okay.
Whereas for the Democrats, it's kind of an even thing. What we saw after Parkland was this enormous surge in pro-gun control beliefs, people saying they cared about it, and then it died down after 6 weeks, 8 weeks. I think if you got close to an election, one of these events, maybe it would not die down that quickly and could have an impact in the other direction. But certainly, my expectation is we're going to have a surge of interest in gun control, but so far it hasn't had the legs to really create a Republican backlash. I think Republicans are on thin ice here. The kids being shot in schools is very vivid, the image of it. The lack of outrage, the Republican cozying up with NRA, that's not a long-term winner. At some point, there is going to be a surge on the other side because it reminds me in a sort of odd way of busing in the 1970s, a highly unpopular issue that the Democrats were pro-busing, pro-integration, but the public at large was very anti. There were points where it sort of became a focus, and those were very good for Republicans. So gun control is the mirror image of that. There's a relatively small part of the Republican Party, the NRA-backed part, that will take extreme positions on it. The public at large is not exercised about it, but it could be a flashpoint with an event.
That's interesting. So here in California, for example, Gavin Newsom, the lieutenant governor, the front runner in most California polls for governor, Gabby Giffords, the Arizona congresswoman, the victim of the shooting in Arizona, she does an ad on behalf of Newsom. Newsom did a ballot proposition in 2016 on gun control. So you can see in California that that's a strong place to be. But nationally, Doug, do Democrats want to do a generic gun control ad?
At the moment, no, because that does not help them in that big swath of red states, which are disproportionately represented in the Senate.
Right.
But the question is, at some point, so today's event in Indiana, last week in Texas, before that in Florida, it's interesting that these things seem to happen in red states.
So getting back to the question of Trump and just kind of the exhaustion that Trump is in the political cycle, just week in and week out of just drama and yelling and screaming back and forth by the parties, and then these various things flaring up during the Newsweek, Doug, is anything really kind of cracking through to voters right now, or is this going to be like 2016 and just a question of what side of the argument you come down on?
Well,
I guess what I'm getting at is there's anything out there that you think can kind of tip? And you suggested guns.
Yeah, so I think there are a lot of things that can tip.
Okay.
So gun control, I don't think it will,
right?
It could. The Me Too thing, which mobilizes Democrats, but it also seems to have a backlash among the Republican white male base.
Right.
Those are the sort of things that could move some voters across the country.
Mm-hmm.
The party that controls the presidency has a natural spokesman. The problem is the Republican spokesman here, Donald Trump, is not really interested in carrying a party message.
Right.
And the Democrats have no, you know, their congressional leadership is definitely not a plus in carrying the message, and they don't really, no one has emerged as this is the go-to person that will be on the TV carrying the Democratic message, nor do I feel the Democrats have anything approximating a clear message about why they're the alternative
right.
to Trump.
They could try people in individual districts. They could trot out Barack Obama. They could trot out Michelle Obama, who I think is right. still pretty popular in most polls. But, yeah, in terms of who is a brand ambassador for the party right now, awfully good question.
Yeah, I don't think Obama, you know, if he were to take a very partisan position, I think it would be, in his view, unpresidential. And, someone will emerge. The Democrats will have a nominee in 2020.
Yes.
But it's not clear that between now and then they will have someone who is the go-to person for carrying their message.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I just wrote a column, Doug, where I listed six different people who will hold office in California. Well, Tom Steyer is on the list, but six different Californians plus Oprah who could be in a presidential conversation just in California alone.
Right.
But our poll actually surveyed on some presidential people and found Kamala Harris, the U.S. Senator, in the best
right.
position. But she had pretty high unknowns within her own state as well. So
yeah.
I don't know. You know, if there's the me generation, there's the meh generation, where just voters don't seem tuned in.
Yes. That's most people aren't as excited as we are about this.
No, good stuff. All right, Doug Rivers, thanks for the conversation. I sure enjoyed it.
Always a pleasure, Bill. Look forward to getting together after the election.
Well, we might do it before the election, too, if you don't mind.
All right.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to download. Have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Doug Rivers and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Doug Rivers is on Twitter, and his Twitter handle is @Doug_Rivers. That's Doug_Rivers. YouGov also is on Twitter. Its Twitter handle is, not surprisingly, @YouGov, and that's spelled YOUGOV, @YouGov. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. I'm Chris Dower for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.